I think we're, Laura was saying she's sorry she took so long. I really do want to move through this fairly quickly because I think with Laura's presentation and then the theory, and I took a little longer probably telling stories, I don't want to shortchange this story, but again, this is a change in perspective. So I think you've really seen seed scale in operation in Peru, and learning about the CLAS project really gives that scale cubed integration and its successes and ups and downs. And I wanted to just move very quickly through the through this China presentation. As I say, it was a little bit of a challenge because I really had so much fun listening to Dad and Bob Parker talking about their experiences, and that's another, well, okay, moving right along. So one of the key things that founded, it's a little bit jumpy, thank you. If you go to the Declaration of Alma-Ata and think about how Alma-Ata happened, one of the backstories for why Alma-Ata happened in Alma-Ata, Kazakhstan, was an awareness and work by Ken Newell and other people that there were these successful programs around the world. And one of the key programs that was used as absolutely foundational to everybody's thinking in the late 60s, early 70s was the success of the Barefoot Doctors Program in China. It started by John Grant, 1932, with C.C. Chen, Jimmy Yen, and Y.C. Chen, excuse me. But they did their project in Dingxian and had developed a model PHC system in the 1930s. There's actually some interesting history. There were several model primary healthcare systems in the 30s around the world. And the Barefoot Doctor Program really helped China achieve very remarkable gains in the 50s and 60s, 1950 through 1980, except for the Great Leap Forward, and I have a graphic on that. And those were attributed to the Barefoot Doctor System and the Dingxian experiment. And then starting in the late 70s to middle 80s, there were economic reforms that really started to benefit the rural areas and started reducing economic and health disparities that existed between rural and urban. But starting after the mid-80s, the reforms mostly benefited urban and coastal regions, and the rural-urban disparities started to increase. Now, I apologize to any China scholars and defer to them in the audience, because I think this is a very macro view, and I'm sure there are a lot of nuances that this glosses over. But this was a perception that was very real in UNICEF and in Hopkins, as they look back over it. And this graphic shows the infant mortality rates in China starting in 1950 and the dramatic improvements that were achieved. The data from 1980 on was somewhat more by conjecture and inference, but Bob Parker can describe better about the reasons why they felt that there was a fairly flat infant mortality rate for a number of years there in the 1980s, and then the spike is during the Great Leap Forward. So I've drawn heavily from, this is a very touchy, okay, I've drawn very heavily, and I want to credit Bob Parker for this section because, and this is the title that he gives to it, and so some other time people can talk about whether they concur with that sort of thing. But, whoa. Yeah, okay, thank you. And there were major changes, that, but then starting in the 1980s, as I've said, what was happening behind the scenes is the number of village and township health workers began to drop. Half of the barefoot doctors started to move into other professions where they could earn more money. The recognition started to be less. It was not part of the commune's work points that was driving what the barefoot doctor did. But as they started some of the economic reforms, other incentives came into play, and so that fairly structured barefoot doctor system seemed to be collapsing. The village health stations were closed. There was more of a centralization, more technology-driven changes. They went from 90% coverage with the cooperative health system to 5 to 10% coverage during that time. They went to, at the end of it, 40 to 60% of people in poor areas in the 1990s were not able to get needed inpatient and outpatient services. And there were some, Bob Parker doesn't have the exact data, but there was pretty reliable evidence that the infant mortality rate started going up. So I shift here. That was the situation. Dad had his deep friendship with Jim Grant, who's on the right. That's Dr. Ding in the middle, who's actually kept bringing Dad back to China. It kept Dad going for many years to be able to go back and talk with him, and Dad's there on the left. And it was that deep affection and friendship and the relationship between Dad and Jim Grant where Jim led to having Dad initially as a consultant. So the way the talk is presented, the slides will talk about two phases, but in my listening to the tapes, I actually identify four phases. And the prelude to the Model Counties program was that Dad was brought in on consultancy under Jim Grant to help China analyze, and he was the expert, and they said, oh, you have to sort of fund community-based programs, and it didn't really work. They gave money, and the money was then used by the counties. They gave it to the communities and thought they had all the controls in place, and several of the counties went and developed their maternal child health care diagnostic units and specialty neonatal centers. Many of the counties bought ultrasounds, which eventually became used to determine the gender of the baby and all the implications from that. And so that initial consultation, so Dad, you know, said, you got to do this and put it forward, it didn't work. So then the first phase, which is where I'll pick up the story, and Dad talked about being invited then by Jim Grant to come to China. Dad would never, he was always positive, but there was a little edge to the way he would tell the story that Jim might have said, you've been talking about this, come and see if you can do any better. You've been an academic, now you try and run the largest UNICEF program in the world and be country director and see if you can make it work. And so Dad, whether or not that was an actual conversation, Dad was like, this is my chance to put things into practice. They had the 10 experimental counties, and they had the outside-in partnership with the medical schools, and that is what I'll talk about as phase one in the slides, but in my head it's phase two. And then the slides and the presentation talk about scaling up to 300 counties, and they call that phase two, but there was a failure in between where they learned and adapted. So out of the narrative, I'm going to be injecting those comments and trying to keep within my time. So there's Jim Grant out in the field, and they both loved going out in the field. And Carl also credits the success of the project to the enabling environment that was created by Madame Lin Xiaomei on the right-hand side, who was minister of MCH at the time, and coincidentally the wife of the president, who's on the left-hand side. So the president of China's wife was also the minister, and that's a pretty good enabling environment. Dad, true to form, loved to go to the villages. He just loved being out there, and he learned so much. I think it was Archie said that he never took the elevator at the School of Public Health. He was always walking, and he was always moving, and moving very fast when he was School of Public Health, but when he was in the villages, he was always stopping. I loved that yesterday, or Saturday. They went out and they took detailed measurements. The six medical universities were actually doing field studies. There was very intensive analysis of 10 counties in China, and they were selected in all the appropriate ways to create a model demonstration. And so these are some of the field work and actually going out and having the meetings, talking to people and doing that. So remember the steps. I'm not going to be quite as rigid adhering to the different tasks, but this is the principle on evidence, local evidence. They went out in this phase in the 10 county project and gathered the real evidence. And they presented that evidence to the local local officials at the county level and to the provincial officials and to the officials in Beijing, and they had those discussions. They had the people from Beijing coming out and seeing the model counties. They had Madame Ling Jiamei come out and visit the counties. They had that communication that was happening. They also, you know, they were not opposed to hospital-based work or high-tech work, but it was, in the words of Alma Ata, appropriate technology. And so these were the systems. These were the healthcare facilities. This is the reality. That's the reality, too. They would go out and see how it was working, what was really happening. And they would come back and talk and have these very energized discussions. It's a little hard to see, but it's easier because he's got gray hair and is balding. That's Bill Ranke in the back right-hand corner, the Hopkins expert on operations research. So Bill believed it too. He didn't just preach it in health planning. He was out there doing the ground level operations research. This is in one of the minority communities where they're working with those community health workers who remain, the barefoot doctors. They had groups of community people who came together and talked about what was happening and put together their summary about what worked. Oral rehydration clearly worked, so that there was a tension that's talked about in Dad's last paper between Jim Grant and Carl about whether they should do the low-hanging fruit of Gobi versus the comprehensive integrated approach. And so Gobi, this was a UNICEF program. They had Gobi components, but they were also using those vertical categorical programs to develop and strengthen the community infrastructure. And if you want to understand that dynamic, Carl's got his paper called The Straw Men of Primary Care that he wrote during this time with Richard DeJolly, who was the deputy director at UNICEF there. Skipping ahead here. So they did then, there was a lower level here before the 10 counties, where Dad was a consultant. They had this success in the 10 counties, and it was a dramatic success, and everybody loved it, and big policy experiment. And then they moved to a 20-county pilot. So in business terms, the 10 counties was a prototype, a proof of concept. Does it, you know, we know it works in theory, does it work in practice? But the 20-county was the beta test. They took what they thought was working and they applied it to the 20 counties without all the extra stuff, and it seemed to work. What is not shown, well, it's shown there as a direct line to the 65-county project, but what they developed in the 65-county project in 1987 was what Dad later called the blueprint or cookie cutter approach. They thought they had found the integrated package. Sound familiar to a lot of international health policy, integrated packages? They're good packages developed from the field, but they thought they had the magic integrated package, and they went to those 65 counties, and they tried to apply it, and it flopped. And in the interest of time, I won't go into all the details of what happened there, but they then said, ooh, it flopped. They didn't give up. They said it didn't work. They went back to their drawing boards, and they then moved into the 300. There actually was a phase of where they went from the lessons learned in the 10 counties to 95, and then they went to 300, and then they extended actually nationwide. The extension nationwide was based on 300 counties of China, which is a lot of people. They then modified the governmental policies and had that discussion with government so that the whole national infrastructure started to adapt. At this point, Carl and Bob Parker have lost the thread because they turned it over. So something that would be very interesting is, what's happened to the Model County Project? Is it sustained? I don't know, but you all may know, so I'd be interested. But so this is just summarizing that the lessons that they learned when they had the flop at 65 and tried it again at 95, they learned that they didn't do enough community level planning, that they had not put into the contracts the contractual relationship between the county, the province, and the federal government, and they spelled it out in detailed contracts so the money couldn't be diverted. The academic institutions in the failed project were asked to implement and replicate the model in their neighborhoods, and that was changed. The academic institution's role was shifted to being a learning center and action research, and they also then applied comprehensive and in the 95 project, the 95 county project, there was not necessarily 100% scaling up, but that's okay. The way the programs expanded varied. So this was just a reminder about the 65 county. And so those were the changes that I just went through about what they had done. These are the changes they made when they went to 300 counties. Ooh, I'm getting my numbers. They went to the 300 and they made these changes, and the national level, because of the success of the 300, was now more receptive to change, and they created the possibility of change at the national level. They also implemented this regional stepwise training, and there's a lot of detail about that implementation. And they started the ongoing planning and evaluation. This is more about the details. But again, the bottom, fitting with the current interpretation of seed scale, they mobilized the energy and excitement at all levels. They found the leaders at the community, the county, the province, national level, and they engaged them and had them motivated. And these are the impact results. And I'm going, in the interest of time, I'm going to stop with this slide. But what's intriguing to me is that the places where seed scale has been applied, and correct me if I'm wrong, Laura, but people are seeing twofold changes, either doublings or cutting in half. Is that about what you all have seen? Okay. But in Afghanistan and in Arunachal, they have seen these significant changes. And that's what Carl's saying. When you know it when you see it. You walk into a community and you see that something is different. And it's that level of change that we're talking about achieving. So thank you. And I'm worried I've probably gone over time. So
thank you. Thank you so much, Henry, for sharing that with us. Really sorry that we're running over time, but are there questions right now? It's a good thing that we're running into the lunch hour, so anyone who is not rushing out to lunch can stay for a little while. Do you have a question back here?
Uh-huh. And the other part was going forward from these numbers, we know increase further reductions in infant mortality focus a lot more on newborn interventions. And those are the ones that were not covered a lot by GOBI and were not covered by the initial child survival interventions. So and I also find in my own work trying to remove things that communities think work and are very enthusiastic. stem that enthusiasm for. And then the other is the injecting innovation, things they don't even know about, and then the value of outside funding.
Well, those are interesting questions. But I mean, in terms of having outside funding, essential, of course. We could not have done it, of course, without the outside in change agents. It's good to have funding to survive. But how much of that funding actually is injected into the community and into the government is you know, the next question. And in this particular project, by trying to make sure that the local governments and the government system, Ministry of Health system, was putting in enough money and budgeting enough money for some of these activities to be sustainable, we were able to measure a $4.5 million local contribution, mobilizing local resources during the period of this project. So, I mean, no, we can't do it. Okay, in terms of changing government community ideas about different different methodologies or different interventions, this is a matter of negotiating with the outside-in change agent. That would be one of the roles of the change agent, would be to bring in new information and new ideas that would be correcting old information that would be out of date, I think. I don't know if I answered all of your questions. Tom, head up, and then we'll have Gretchen. Okay.
Building on this previous question, I wonder if you've done any speculation as to what a country would have to spend and how they would upgrade their outside-in capabilities. It's fine to have USAID do something here, something there, but you're never going to be able to do it countrywide. And you're really going to have to rely on your local outside-in resources and so forth. And what would it cost?
For the outside-in agencies?
Replicating the kind of thing you did, using Peruvian prices, Peruvian personnel, outside-in, as well as government, to really see whether you can go.
Right. Well, yeah, exactly. We didn't, of course, we don't have that measurement, but I think maybe the real answer to that would be that you eventually are able to impact the scale cubed level of, it's a third level scaling up from scale to scale squared to scale cubed. So scale cube would be the policy environment that you are able to affect. Changing the rules and regulations of the government. And so that provides sustainability to the new processes that are going on. So it's good if you have the outside agents that are actually working on the policy environment. And we did that. We actually passed a law during the period of this program that I didn't mention. Oh, sorry. Yes. Gretchen.
Issues that you touched on and that I find absolutely crucial is that you get the equity of representation of the voices. You know, people keep talking about, we went in and met with the community. What do they mean? Do they mean men? Do they mean women? Would anyone be representing the voice of the under fives with that community meeting? And so, you know, I was interested that getting equity into it so late in the process, because if you have a simple map of a community and everybody who's there talking and vocalizing comes from the north side or the south side or whatever, then you get very biased information, you know, from that community. And furthermore, our studies have shown you is that you always leave out the poorest of the poor and the despairing and most neglected, you know, such as mothers who are single parent and their household. So our experience is to start with kind of a mapping and being able to get representation, you know, both from geographically and by gender, you know, and by, you know, different strata. Because if you go, at least in Haiti where we work most, but also it's true in Africa, you get the big male voice. And, you know, if you wait until way down the street, been getting equity and finally getting the voices of these mothers in, sometimes very late, you know, to hear what they say. So I just wondered, you know, how long have you been there before you got equitable distribution of the voices of the community?
That's a really hard question to answer, and I can't even start to answer that in a very short period of time. But I think we relied a lot on community leaders and orienting them to these criteria of equity, and that they need to think about their own communities and identifying who is the most vulnerable in their own community. And then, you know, on a more macro level, working with the poorest communities to begin with. So there's different levels of working with equity, and the intra-community equity, I'm sure, is very critical.
What's your experience, not just in Missouri, but elsewhere, in local leadership, local communities or whatever, levels of integrity versus self-interest versus that whole range of behaviors?
Do you want to answer that question? I'm going to ask Henry to take a stab at that question.
And actually, I think this is part of the, and Laura's project has it very much, but part of this notion of the relationships and how you, fundamentally, what I hear that question is how do you know you can trust the relationship, right? Can I trust that the person I'm talking to is the right person? Same as what Gretchen's was doing. I think it was a tangent here. I mean, it's a matter of trust. What is it? What's it going to take for you to trust people? So I'm doing that sort of rhetorical question, because unless you focus on the relationship and the trusted relationship, and when you're the outside-in expert going in, you're flying blind. So another response to all of the other questions here is it only works if you really have that three-way partnership, the relationship, and a balanced relationship. And that's where Marxist, a variety of philosophies, but Marxist approaches about analyzing power dynamics, business approaches about looking at the money flow. This isn't saying we have another magic bullet. This is saying it is a complex system, recognize it's a complex system, and the complexity in your success is based on the connections of all the pieces and how you glue it all together in your situation. So how do you know whether to trust a local leader? You ask the people. There are a lot of anecdotes that people who are successful at really listening can find the people who are less likely to pursue interests. Negotiating strategies will help you define how their interest can meet your interest, and a good politician at the scale cubed level will help you see where the win-win-wins, not just the win-win dyad, but the triple or the quadruple or quintuple wins. How do you align those different agendas? And the experience is there, but it is scattered and anecdotal. I think that is the future of what we're looking at, is how do we start measuring the relational aspects and the trust and how people achieve that trust over time, not a one-time shot. But these projects all take 10 to 15 years to implement, and we have to set up that surveillance for equity to monitor it longitudinally. And that's the cutting edge. It does happen. And as we open our eyes to that dimension, we will see it. But we haven't been looking there.
I would just add one other point I could add to that would be that if you run into a municipal mayor or a health facility chief who is doesn't want to collaborate, who is very self-interested, and is not going to be able to take forward the work in the way that needs to be taken forward, then you just say, okay, well, we'll go over and work with this other health facility or in this other municipality, and we'll work with these people over here. And then you start developing, you know, relationships that are more, you know, fruitful in other places, and then eventually you come back to the first one, and maybe the person has changed, you know, he's been voted out, or he's been replaced, and there's somebody else that you can work with, or else the same person has seen the progress that can be made someplace else with a new attitude, and so then maybe he will change his attitude. So I think that's how we found to be successful is work in the places that want to work with you first, and just, you know, you just can't hit your head against a brick wall, you know, too much. Just go where they're going to respond to you first, and then the brick wall starts coming down.
Thanks. Because of travel and stuff, I'm having to run to catch a plane, but this is the discussion we can keep having. Dad would refer you to, or I will refer you to hear it in Dad's words at the about two-thirds of the way through Just and Lasting Change. He talks about the Torah Mera principle. Torah Mera was a very influential person in Turkey and Iran. Very influential friend of Dad's, and the story is told there, but it's specifically, I mean, Dad wasn't born with this stuff. Yeah, he had some amazing context. He had to learn this the hard way. And he had 93 years to do trial and error. But in that story, he tells about how Torah Mera taught him. Thanks, and I'm sorry I have to run, Laura. So.
Oh, it's okay.
Okay, that was great.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you for attending this session. Appreciate your attendance. And if